Thank you for joining us. I'm Michelle Martin, host of NPR's Tell Me More, sitting in for Diane Rehm. A key Senate vote earlier today puts President Obama one step closer to achieving his top domestic priority, overhauling health care. The bill was passed without a single Republican vote, and Republican leaders vehemently denounced the bill for what they said would be its harmful effects on the economy. Joining me in the studio to talk about what's in the bill, what was left out, and how it all came together, and what's next, Carrie Boudoff-Brown with Politico, Susan Denser of Health Affairs, and Mary Agnes Carey with Kaiser Health News. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Great thank to be you. With you.
Carrie, you were there for the vote, so we want to thank you, first of all, for having taking a very long night and getting up early to be with us. What was the atmosphere there, if you were able to keep yourself awake to watch it?
Sure. No, I was. And it was interesting. I mean, this is kind of a strange atmosphere because it's 1 a.m. and senators are literally getting out of their cars, going up an elevator and going into the chamber. And they sat down as they do during key votes. They did that during the Iraq War, during Supreme Court nomination confirmation votes. So they're all sitting in their chairs and one by one stood up and said yes or no. And there really, you know, there really wasn't any mystery, actually. There were some people were warning, well, maybe something strange will happen. It played out just as Harry Reid had hoped it would.
But did it have an air of solemnity? Did it have an air of importance? It's interesting to me how often these historic moments actually seem so banal in the moment. It's later on that they feel important. Did it
feel like
an important moment?
Vicky Kennedy was sitting in the gallery with a couple of administration officials. And I think that, more than anything, was a very, you know, kind of, it gave the moment a little bit more of an historical context. And there was a lot of talk of Ted Kennedy throughout the day. And she was very emotional. And I caught her off the Senate floor right afterwards. And John Kerry was already there embracing her. And Chuck Schumer rushed up, Tom Harkin did. And then they all walked downstairs and there was like a receiving line in a reception room off the Senate chamber for Vicky Kennedy. And that's when it got kind of emotional for Democrats who had really, you know, had really fought for this alongside Ted Kennedy for decades.
Vicky Kennedy, of course, being the widow of Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, who died earlier this year after a bout with cancer, who had not spoken very much publicly,
exactly.
But who had published an op-ed in the preceding days leading up to the vote. Mm-hmm. Do you think that made a difference?
I'm not sure it really did. I mean, I think it was probably helpful for people to hear from Ted Kennedy as close as the person as you could get right before the vote. But I really think many weeks ago, Democrats decided that they had to pass this. And I think in the last 2 weeks, that feeling really gelled as the Senate Republicans were becoming more determined to slow things down and make this a problem. There was an anecdote that a couple of newspapers had over the weekend about Evan Bayh at the White House last week saying, I do not want to see the happy look on Republicans' faces if they succeed in putting up obstacles to this. We cannot let them succeed. And so that was apparently like a rallying cry for Democrats. And really at that moment when there was a lot of division, I think it was last Tuesday, kind of got them back on the same page. And despite the loss of the public option, despite it not being everything they wanted to, the idea of them sticking together to pass something kind of triumphed over any of their differences.
Before I bring in the other guests, very briefly, why were they voting at 1 o'clock in the morning?
It's because of the Senate procedural rules and the need to break a filibuster required 30 hours before they could vote, and literally the 30 hours ended at 1 a.m., and they're on this tight time schedule to get this done before Christmas Eve, and literally they're voting as soon as they can procedurally on the time clock, and so that means a series of strange votes this week, 7 a.m. tomorrow, 1 p.m. on Wednesday, 7 p.m. on Christmas Eve, unless Republicans yield back time.
Am I sad? Am I sad for them?
Are you sad for the senators?
I'm sad for their families.
Yeah, exactly. And the staff who have to stay there.
I'm sure many people will have questions, so let me give the number right away. It's 1-800-433-8850, 1-800-433-8850. You can also contact us through the drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And I'm sure many people have questions. Let's dig into the substance of the bill. All of you have been covering this for such a long time. So, Susan, it's almost hard to know where to begin. But does it feel like an historic moment to you?
It clearly is, Michelle, for all kinds of reasons. The partisanship, first of all, in Washington is clearly at an all-time high. The ice sheets of partisanship are thicker than they've ever been. That feels historic. But beyond that, the healthcare reform itself is historic. This is as big a change as has been made in the healthcare programs of the United States, and frankly, not just those of the government, but those of the American people in generations. So the fact that the Senate could hold this 60-40 majority and get this initial vote itself, even though, as Carrie says, it's just one of several procedural votes, on one level, it's just Senate procedure. On another level, it means they've held their 60-40 majority and they have the votes to put this through. Now, we are a long way from the conclusion on this, because even if this bill passes on Christmas Eve, it goes to conference with a very, very different House version of the bill, and who knows what happens from there. But so far, so good.
Let's try to walk through the substance of the bill, and I'm going to ask each of you to kind of pick up the ball, since there's a lot to talk about. So, Susan, why don't you start? How many people are covered? Let's just talk about the significance of the bill. How many people are covered, and how do they get to it's my understanding that it goes to, the bill aims to cover 94% of Americans. How do they get to 94%?
The Congressional Budget Office, which is the nonpartisan scorekeeper of Congress, says that by 2019, under the legislation, 31 million more people would have insurance. About 23 million people in the country would still be uninsured. About a third of those would be undocumented immigrants. Of the 31 million people who would be covered, about 26 million of those people would actually be buying coverage through the new health insurance exchanges. These are like these new food courts of health insurance that will be created under the Senate bill in every state across the country, where you'll be able to go in, comparison shop among standardized benefits packages that will be offered by various private insurers, and pick the one you want. On top of that, you will also, under the Senate bill, you would also have the option of buying coverage through one or another of two national health insurance plans, one of which has to be a nonprofit plan. That would be available nationwide. And then, of course, 15 million more people than currently is the case would be eligible for Medicaid and CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program. So you roll all that together, plus certain provisions that are aimed at keeping people who have employer-based coverage in those systems. That's how we get to 31 million insured.
So there's coverage, but what about cost? The two discussions that we've been having all year, and indeed for the years leading up to this moment, are extending coverage, but what about the spiraling cost of health care? Mary Agnes, how is cost addressed in this bill?
Well, that's been a great debate about the Senate bill. One provision that's in there that economists agree could control health care costs is an excise tax on the high-value health insurance plans. And here we're talking about health insurance plans that would cost about $23,000 for family coverage or $8,500 for individuals. They've also made several changes in Medicare spending in the years ahead. They're cutting reimbursements for certain providers. One that comes to mind is the Medicare Advantage Program. These are the private health insurance plans and Medicare. That will be viewed as a way to help reduce health care costs. But there is great debate about whether this bill will do enough. Should it do enough? A lot of freshman Democrats, a group of them led by Mark Warner of Virginia, had several cost containment amendments. They were included in the bill. They do more to link the payment that a provider, a doctor, a hospital will get under Medicare to the quality of care delivered.
What's the biggest change for most people already get their insurance through their employer?
Right.
And for those people, does anything change?
I believe the proponents of the bill would tell you that you should have comfort in knowing that if you lost your health insurance, that you would be able to still get health insurance, because this bill would seek to reduce the number of uninsured. They would say that if you were close to the Medicare program or someone in your family were, it strengthens the Medicare program, increases the solvency of the program. And the thought is, through the exchanges, or as Susan talked about, these national plans offered, that you would have more choice to get your health insurance if, for example, you had to purchase it on your own. But that the entire discussion about, in Medicare, for example, that's a big part of the health insurance sector. The government's a big player. So if Medicare is more efficient, changes the way it pays for health insurance, the care delivered, that will have positive effects for people who currently have coverage.
What is the biggest surprise in this bill? I mean, there are so many there was so much back and forth over the question of whether there was a public option or not, whether there would be one, whether there could be one. And I had the opportunity to speak with Illinois Senator Roland Burris last week, the junior senator from Illinois who took Barack Obama's seat. And he was one of the holdouts saying, I will never vote for a bill without a public option. End of story. Full stop. And then when he spoke to him, he said, well, if it achieves the same goal as a public option, then I'm fine with that. So what's the biggest change in this, Susan?
Well, that itself is not a surprise, that because the public option has been, you know, on a serious diet or dying on the vine for the last several months. In fact, by the time the previous Senate bill was introduced, the Congressional Budget Office estimated that only 3 to 4 million Americans would actually enroll in it. So it had already gotten pretty tiny. And I think by the time people just threw in the towel because they realized there really was not going to be a meaningful mechanism for coverage in the way it had been eventually configured.
So it's not a surprise for people who've been covering this bill, but for those who have not been, who are sort of checking in and out of this, is this... I guess maybe this is more of a political question, that this is more of a question of what you believe to be the ideal way to address this as opposed to what is believed to be possible.
Well, notwithstanding the fact that it's not a surprise, it's obviously an unpleasant reality for many, many people who did want the public option. And it's not over because there is a public option still in the House bill. And even though it doesn't look like that will be in a final verdict of product that would pass the Senate, it's still possible that it could be.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will have more on the latest developments in the healthcare debate with Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs and an on-air analyst on health issues with the PBS NewsHour. Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She most recently served as associate editor for CQ Health Beat. That's a daily report on healthcare policy. She's also served as Capitol Hill bureau chief for CQ. And Carrie Budoff Brown, healthcare reporter for Politico. I'm Michelle Martin, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Please stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Michelle Martin, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking with Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News, Carrie Budoff Brown, healthcare reporter for Politico, and Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs. And we're talking about the healthcare overhaul bill that just passed a key hurdle in the Senate, a vote at 1 o'clock in the morning, and Carrie was there. And we thank you for that.
No problem.
We're happy that you were there, because guess what? We weren't. A number of listeners want to know about how the whole question of pre-existing conditions will be addressed. David from, I'm not quite sure where David is, David Massengale emails us and says, I've heard a lot about the pre-existing condition clause in the bills, but I want to know if there's anything in there to prevent the insurance companies from charging outrageous premiums to cover them. And he's from Charlotte, North Carolina, and he goes on to tell us, and I assume he doesn't mind us sharing that. He says, my wife has a chronic condition whose treatment costs about $1,000 a month. She's currently covered, but if she loses her insurance, what is to stop the next company from charging us $2,000 a month? And first, David, let me say I am sorry for this challenge in your family. Mary Agnes, what about that?
Well, I think he raises a good point. There isn't anything in the bill that would put a cap on how much insurers could charge to take care of his wife or someone else with a pre-existing condition. What the bill would do is right away it would say that you couldn't deny coverage based on pre-existing conditions for children, but it would kick in for adults once the health care insurance exchanges are up and running in 2014. But his point about the price is one well taken. Wasn't dealt with in the bill. I'm going to turn to my colleagues here for a second, but I don't think there's anything in the House bill either that caps anything they can charge.
No, Susan? I think the one provision that might give him some comfort is that immediately upon passage, the wheels start turning to set up a high-risk pool, a nationwide high-risk pool that would be available for people who do have very costly conditions, who at least would have the ability to buy coverage. Now, we don't know what the price of that is going to be, but at least there would be access for people who would otherwise probably be uninsured.
What's the politics of covering kids with pre-existing conditions first and then adults later in 2014? Is this a political question or an economic question or both?
A little bit of both. Well, first of all, kids are cheap to cover, period, and not many children have pre-existing conditions. So it's an easy group of people to let into the coverage tent quickly, if you will. More importantly, the pre-existing condition restriction realistically can only be lifted when everybody has to buy coverage, because otherwise you have what is known in insurance as adverse selection. Only the sick people will sign up for insurance. So all of these changes have to go into effect together. And frankly, it's clearly going to be several years before all of these things can be done. That's why, at least in the Senate version, all of this doesn't happen until 2014.
We have a lot of questions about the politics of how the bill came together. And we also have a lot about the details of what's in the bill. So I think we'll go to the details of what's in the bill first, because I'm sure that's something that a lot of people are very anxious about. And then we'll save some time at the end to talk about the politics. So for those of you who have questions about the political process, I know I do. Hold on to those questions. We'll get to them in a minute. But first, we're going to go to Mike in South Haven, Michigan. Mike.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you. My question really has to deal with, why is it that Congress is so against giving the entire country the same level of health care that they receive at taxpayer cost and are all worried about taxpayers having to pay for those folks who simply can't get insurance?
Well, in fact, under the Senate bill that looks like it's now going to pass, Americans would all have the option of enrolling in roughly the same package of benefits that members of Congress do, because the new nationwide plan that would be available, or at least one of two plans that would be available, would be administered by the Office of Personnel Management, which is the entity in the federal government that administers the federal employees' health benefits plan. That's the one that members of Congress are eligible for, along with about 8 million other federal workers and their dependents. So this coverage is available. Now, we don't know exactly what the price of that is going to be. We don't know exactly at this point what individuals are going to have to contribute toward that coverage. But we do know that that's going to be available under this bill as of 2014.
And that, I think that, just to add, Carrie? I think that inclusion that only came in the last few weeks, this idea of extending roughly the same kind of coverage and giving that option for people, was a very smart move politically for Democrats, because a rallying cry since 1994 has been, why can't we get the same coverage that members of Congress have? And so Democrats kind of turned that kind of tried to answer that and said, we're going to do it. And it's going to be an interesting interplay with Republicans, I think, in the next year as to how Democrats use that, because that's been a very popular, you know, line that people have used for many, many years.
We have a question from, is it St. Augustine or St. Augustine? Johnny, how do you say it?
It'd be St. Augustine.
St. Augustine, Florida. So, Johnny, what's your question?
My question is, given that the government has bankrupted Medicare, or almost bankrupted, why should I believe that they can handle the health care of essentially the entire country without either destroying the medical system or causing us to go maybe 5 years from now and go, oh, boy, that was a terrible idea, but now we've got trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. And so I don't understand that, and no one's been able to successfully explain to me how it is that the government will manage to do this properly, but fraud and things that run rampant with all other government-supplied things.
All right. Well, hold on. Let's see if we can get an answer for you. And I also want to mention we have another question coming in on email that's a similar one. It says medical expenses in the U.S. are double what they are in most industrialized nations. What does this bill do to cap such excessive profits? So a related question, not the same, Mary Agnes?
I think that for your caller, the thought is, with the Office of Personnel Management, it administers health benefits for federal employees and their dependents, and I want to say that's about 8 or 10 million people. So the thought is that you've got an entity that has experience negotiating these plans and implementing them, so that should possibly give people some comfort. Now, his question about the financing is an interesting one, because the Congressional Budget Office has said in its analysis that, for example, in the plan, there are about, I think it's about $400 billion of spending reductions in the Medicare program over the next decade. The Congressional Budget Office has said, you know, Congress kind of has a hard time sticking to this, because you get a lot of lobbying, a lot of pushback from the industries involved, and they may not be able to make the reductions that they're saying they will, even though now they're currently in the bill. So if Congress did not follow through on those reductions, the bill would cost more money and could not, maybe it possibly wouldn't have the same revenue and spending, and deficit reduction numbers it currently has. So I think there's room for skepticism there.
It is the case, though, that some provisions were added in the so-called manager's amendment that Senator Reid introduced that do have the effect of toughening these provisions. For example, a new independent payment advisory board would be created, and which essentially would be able to make recommendations to Congress about what to do with spending provisions under Medicare. The CBO says that as a result of that provision, Medicare spending under the legislation would actually increase at a lower rate, 6% a year, as opposed to 8% a year, which is the rate it has been increasing it yet. Now, this sounds like a small difference, but when you multiply this by the size of the Medicare program over a number of years, it is massive amounts of potential savings in Medicare. So while all of this has to be implemented, it has to be done. Mary Agnes is right. You know, just because you pass a bill doesn't say all these things are going to happen. But if they were to happen, we'd see some dramatic reductions in the rate of growth of healthcare spending.
Can anyone address, though, for me, why there is this huge cost differential between the U.S. and our industrial peers in the percentage of our economy that goes to healthcare, despite the fact that so many people remain uninsured? What's the key factor here?
One key factor is prices. We pay higher prices for all aspects of healthcare in the United States than almost any other country. We pay higher prices for branded drugs. We pay higher prices for hospitals. We pay our doctors better than anybody else. So a huge amount of this is just, frankly, the price level.
It's not that we get more stuff. We just pay more for it.
We pay a lot more for it. We also do get some more stuff, and we have, in particular, no brakes on letting lots of new technology into the system, whereas other countries do. And that is a driver of our costs as well.
That is its own interesting issue, I think, right. Because that has been one of the central arguments around this healthcare overhaul, is whether innovation will be stifled by this. And let's take another call from St. Louis, Missouri. Chaz, you had a question?
I would like to preface by just saying that I think any plan that doesn't include either a single payer or a public option is just a boondoggle. But my question is, too, when they switched over to digital broadcasting, they said the government was going to give everybody money to help them get a converter. And it wasn't enough to actually purchase a converter, but most of it. This pay the help that people are going to get medical insurance, how much are they going to get as opposed to how much it's really going to cost? What's the difference? And if they don't get the medical insurance because they can't afford it, these people are already poor, what's the penalty going to be on these people for not getting insurance if they can't afford it?
That's a good question. Chaz, can I just ask you, did you get one of those converter boxes?
No, I didn't. I have cable TV.
You have
so
cable.
I don't need to.
So, yeah. Okay, so you weren't sure. But what about that? So, Mary Agnes, do you want to answer that?
Sure.
Thank you, Chaz.
It's called the individual mandate is what he's talking about, and the penalty that you'll have to pay. It would be by the implementation, full implementation by 2016, it would be either $750 for an individual or 2% of income. I want to say for families, it's capped at about $2,200 or so for a penalty. But his concern is very interesting. He talks at the top of his question about if you don't have a public plan, you don't have single payer, it's a boondoggle. There are critics of the plan that say, now, wait a minute, we don't have a public plan in this. There are questions about whether or not the subsidies will be enough to help people meet their co-pays and deductibles and so on. But yet you're going to have a mandate. You will break the law with some exceptions. There are some carve-outs for this, but you'll break the law if you don't have coverage. Very much a concern among people who wanted that public plan to be one uniform option available to everyone in the country.
Susan, did you want to add to this?
Well, I would just say that there isn't a whole, notwithstanding the fact that there isn't technically something called a public plan or a public option, this new nationwide health insurance entity that would be available to people, one, there would be two, and one of them has to be nonprofit. That isn't going to look a whole lot different than the public option would have looked to people. So in theory, it is the kind of entity that's not going to have to pay high rates of returns to shareholders, for example, which does add to the cost of coverage for people who have private health insurance. So there are at least some mechanisms here that would address the caller's concern.
That leads very neatly to this whole question of how this deal was put together. And one of the ways this deal was put together were various concessions to various senators who had various interests in their districts. I think we should talk about that for a minute. But I did want to ask before we do, is there any precedent for this or imposing a penalty? I was trying to think of one, and I couldn't. I'm thinking car insurance. You have to have insurance. You're supposed to have insurance to drive a car. And you get penalized very severely if you happen not to have it, if you get into an accident, or if this comes to the attention of the authorities, but you don't have to have a car. Is there anything else like this in our government where you are required to purchase something and you are penalized if you don't?
There's not a lot in the United States, but this is a trend in other countries. For example, Switzerland has an individual mandate provision. The Netherlands has an individual mandate provision. The state of Massachusetts has an individual mandate provision. And it's actually, you know, in Massachusetts now, the estimates are that close to 98% of the population is now covered with health insurance, partly because people, once they have the mandate, even if their employers offer coverage and they're passing it up, now they take it. So even employer-based coverage expands under an individual mandate is at least part of the lesson of the Massachusetts experiment. So it is a growing trend.
We are getting a number of questions about the process, and I'm just going to read one of them. David says, from Charlotte, North Carolina, says he was sickened by the process. He says that Harry Reid bribed Ben Nelson and Mary Landrieu for their votes with taxpayer money. Carrie, did he do that? Ben Nelson being the senator from Oklahoma, Mary Landrieu being the senator from Louisiana. Forgive me. Ben Nelson being the senator from Nebraska, Mary Landrieu from Louisiana. So did he do that? Did he bribe them?
Well, I guess it's, you know, different. One person's trash is another person's treasure, you know, so it's one person's bribe is another person's, you know, form of legislating. And this happened throughout the bill with various senators. There are special provisions for the Vermont on Medicaid. Bernie Sanders was undecided, and they got a little bit of a bigger boost than Nebraska did for their Medicaid program, $600 million,
which didn't get a lot of attention until the very end.
It didn't, because we didn't have we didn't know how much it cost. This happened so quickly. The numbers took a day or two to get out. We didn't know about it. There's special provisions for a small town in Montana that's dealing with asbestos. There's special reimbursement rates for about five states. There's a lot of stuff in this bill that was designed to ease certain concerns of many senators. And it's the ones that get attention are, and especially for those who are holding out, it doesn't look seemly. You know, it looks unseemly to people who are just doing their, you know, going out, doing their thing. And they're thinking, why is this one senator getting $300 million to vote for a bill? That's the way legislating is here in Washington. It's messy. He needed 60 votes. He had no margin for error, and he pretty much did what he had to do.
He being Senate Majority Leader, yes. Harry Reid. Mm-hmm. Talk about Ben Nelson and what role he played in all of this.
Ben Nelson often plays the role of the holdout until the end, and then he goes along. And this time, when abortion became such an issue in the House, that really, and he opposes abortion rights, Ben Nelson, and it became kind of his thing in the Senate. And he said he would filibuster any bill that did not include language as strict as what was in the House. And that became, in the end, the last issue he had to solve. He spent last week talking with Chuck Schumer and Harry Reid. He got his non-abortion issues dealt with by Friday morning. And then he spent the rest of Friday into the late night negotiating through Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer with Barbara Boxer, who was there representing
The pro-choice
community. And they literally went back and forth, rejected a lot of proposals, never sat in the same room. But because he was able to sign on against the wishes of the of some pro-life communities back in Nebraska.
So there's this dramatic moment, as we understand it, where Ben Elson left Harry Reid's office and called the executive director of Nebraska Right to Life, and apparently
a
had a very
call.
Long...
I talked to the woman the other night.
We have only just a couple minutes left before we have to take a short break, but what is the compromise?
The compromise is that they will have two separate... Every exchange has to have offer at least one plan that does not provide for abortion coverage, and those who get public subsidies will have, and if they choose a plan with abortion coverage, they will have to write two separate checks to segregate the funds and provide transparency in that segregation of funds. So it goes a little bit further than the House compromises that was favored by abortion rights proponents by forcing somebody to write two separate checks. But they will not be it allayed the concerns of pro-choice women because they would not be forced to go out and seek out a special rider. You have a menu of plans, hopefully the one that provides abortion coverage, one that does not.
But don't the states have the right to opt out of offering a plan with abortion coverage?
They do, but that right is already there for states to ban coverage of abortion in certain plans.
We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will have more of your calls and questions for our guests, Carrie Budoff-Brown, healthcare reporter for Politico, Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs, and on-air analyst on health officials with the PBS NewsHour, and Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. I'm Michelle Martin, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Please stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This one goes out to the man who minds for miracles.
On the next Fresh Air, The Circle. John Bon Jovi's got a new album. He'll tell us how he got his first big break by convincing a New Jersey DJ to play his music before he had a record deal or even a band. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This road was paved by the winds of change. Walking beside the guilty and the innocent. How will you raise your hand?
Welcome back. I'm Michelle Martin of NPR's Tell Me More, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about that critical vote in the Senate early this morning. We're talking about the healthcare overhaul bill, what it will mean to you, what it means to the country, what it means to the way healthcare is delivered, and how much it costs. We're visiting with Mary Agnes Carey, senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News, Carrie Budoff-Brown, healthcare reporter for Politico, and Susan Dentzer, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs and an on-air analyst on health issues with the PBS NewsHour. Before we took our break, we were talking about the abortion issue and how it affected these these discussions. It's interesting that it hasn't been so much of a top-of-the-mind issue in public life in recent years. I mean, of course, it surfaces in national elections. But it really seemed to, at least from where I was sitting, seemed to kind of take on a life of its own. And so, Carrie, I wanted to ask how this compromise, as it were, came together. The pro-choice side seemed furious about this. They were particularly furious about the Stupak Amendment in the House, which is intended to restrict federal funding for abortion coverage. There are many people who said it would keep women from paying, even with their own money, to get abortion coverage. The Senate seems to address that. But is there still a divide over this issue? And is it going to have to be fought again later on?
There's a strong potential it's going to continue to be a problem in this process. I mean, when I spoke with Ben Nelson on Saturday after this was announced, he said that the Bart Stupak language in the House bill, which came together very last minute as the House tried to pass its bill, that the Stupak language raised the bar for pro-life activists. And for him, he said, well, you know, when that happened, he felt like he had to meet that certain standard. And for the other side, it became a something that, you know, pro-choice advocates had to defeat. And I think the difference between that compromise and what happened over the weekend is that Barbara Boxer and Patty Murray, who are both as pro-choice as it gets, were in the room and signed off on it. And I spoke with Barbara Boxer last night in the halls of the Senate, and she continued to say this is the best compromise we could have come up with. It does not place any additional burden on women. It solves all the problems. Yes, I know my pro-choice supporters are not happy with it, but I'm standing by it. And she spoke with Nancy Pelosi over the weekend, and Pelosi, according to Boxer, was supportive. That will be another key moment when Pelosi actually speaks out about it. Again, you know, for the very same reasons. It seems like also in the House, some women who were, you know, really upset a couple of weeks ago are not speaking out as forcefully against it. And I just think in the end, the desire of Democrats cannot be underestimated in terms of their desire to pass this bill. Politically and every other reason, that is going to take precedence. I think you'll see in the House maybe a tough fight in the conference committee. But I think in the end, just judging from the way Barbara Boxer was talking last night, I think there's some sense that it's going to come together. But even after that, politically, I think this really energized the pro-choice community. I think that they, like you said, it's not been on the top of people's minds lately. I think pro-choice advocates say, you know, this is going to put us back in the game in terms of re-energizing our troops.
Nancy Pelosi being the Speaker of the House. Vivian in Falls Church, Virginia has a question. Vivian.
Thanks for taking my call. I know that the new bill is supposed to outlaw discrimination on basis of gender in setting premiums for health care insurance. I was just wondering when that provision would kick in and, you know, why, if it's going to be later, why that's going to kick in later. I really don't even know what year that would be. That's my question.
I don't know this for certain, but Susan? I believe it's 2014 that kicks in conjunction with all the other insurance provisions in the Senate bill. In the House bill, those kick in a year earlier in 2013. And a reason is that there are going to be so many massive changes to health insurance regulation. They really all have to come about at once. And one of them is that elimination of the gender discrimination provisions. Keep in mind that sometimes those help a particular gender, sometimes they hurt. It kind of depends on your age bracket, whether women benefit from that or men benefit from that. So I think in the great scheme of things, it's just going to kind of even out over across the lifespan.
Vivian, can I ask you, are you still with us?
Yes.
Vivian, overall, how do you feel about the process? A number of listeners are outraged. A lot of people have questions about how the measure will affect them personally. Do you mind if I ask you, what's your sense of it?
I guess I'm a little more realistic about things. I expect it to be messy. I am not happy about everything, but I don't expect to be. And I'd rather have something pass than have nothing pass. And that's really the way I feel. This hasn't happened in decades. It's failed so many times. Powerful people don't want it to happen. Well, we have to at least get started. That's the way I see it. And I just want to see it enacted, and then we'll see how things go from there.
Oh, thank you for calling.
All right. You're welcome.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut Vivian off. Here's Michael in Lafayette, Indiana. Michael, what's your question?
Hi, yes. I was wondering where the idea of Olympia Snowe, she was supposed to be the one Republican that they thought that they could get onto the bill and with her trigger plan possibly do something, but now she ended up voting against since no Republican. Where did she end up? Where did that end up in the whole grand scheme of things?
Michael, thanks for your question. In fact, Michael's question is one that a lot of people have. What happened to Olympia Snowe?
She became very disenchanted with the process, very upset about a variety of things. She was concerned about the time frame. Number one, she kept saying, why are we rushing? We need more time. We need more data. She had asked the Congressional Budget Office for some additional findings on affordability. She was very, very concerned about that. She talked about the manager's amendment. This, again, is what Harry Reid, the majority leader of the Senate, introduced early Saturday morning. She said, wait a minute, this is 400 pages. It has 500 references to other statutes. We've only 450 amendments filed on the bill. We've only considered two dozen. And she was very concerned about the employer mandate. She doesn't like the CLASS Act, which is a long-term health care insurance program. And she said, and we've been talking about this morning, the average person can't tell right now what this bill means to them. Let's slow down. Let's think it through. President Obama has been talking to her a lot over the last week, as has Harry Reid and other Democrats. And she said very clearly yesterday that she was not going to support this.
She felt it was being, to use a crude phrase, rammed down the people's throat or the Republicans' throats or everybody's throats? Is that
I saw
her
argument? On TV yesterday, and she said, look, they're treating this like at the end of the year appropriations bill, throw everything in, pass it as fast as you can. And for something, in her opinion, this large, this comprehensive, a sixth of the economy, let's slow down and think it through. But of course, there's perils for that politically if you do that. As we,
she'll continue to be part of this. She said last night that she is still open to a conference report, and so, and as late as yesterday, she was, or 2 days ago, she was at the White House with the president and being lobbied yesterday in the halls by the legislative director for the White House.
But I'm interested in this whole question of why this had to happen now. I mean, Olympia Snowe has one perspective. She's of course considered a moderate Republican. There was a column last week by David Sirota, who's a progressive columnist, also is a talk show host, and formerly, I believe, worked with Howard Dean. And Howard Dean, who's a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, former governor of Vermont, former presidential candidate, said they should kill the bill. I mean, speaking from the progressive left, saying they should just kill the bill and start over. And David Sirota, this columnist, said that this is just a false argument, that this is the last chance to pass health care for a generation. He says that's just not true. The Democrats are in control today. They'll be in control next week and into next month. So, Carrie, what about that? What about that argument?
Well, Democrats have already spent a year on it, and there is this strong sense that they have to move on politically for themselves to the economy, to jobs, as quickly as possible. They're suffering in the polls because of it. And the way this healthcare has come together, there is a strong belief that you just could not have come back next year, even though it's a week from now, and picked up the ball and gone with this. And there was a lot of call for doing this thing called reconciliation, which you would have, you could pass a bill on with 51 votes, but it would have required it to go back to committee, rewriting the bills. I don't think there is anybody in the Senate leadership that thought that that would mean that they would actually get a bill. Few weeks ago, they pretty much ruled it out.
Why couldn't they?
Because it probably would not have come back until a month or two from now. At the earliest, it would have been severely pared down because of the rules. You can't do any of the insurance market reforms, which were kind of a key part of what Democrats were left with after giving up the public option. I think given how precipitously the poll numbers have dropped on this in the last few months, I don't think it would have gotten better, and they might have been forced to move on.
To Susan?
I think the other 2 points, the 2010 elections are right around the corner. And obviously, if they don't get something done, the political dynamic shifts very clearly in election years. But the other point that's worth making is, Carrie said correctly that they've been at it for a year. I think there are a lot of Democrats who say, no, no, we've been at it for 15 years. We tried to pass this in 94 and it didn't pass. Then we waited, they would say, through the Bush years. Nothing got done about this. The ideas that are on the table, frankly, most of them are not new. Most of them are ideas that have been kicking around for a generation. So from the long perspective, people say, you know, it's high time to get this done.
And it's not going to get the
many political compromises that have had to be made to get these bills put together are not going to get easier. They'll just get harder.
And the Senate still includes a couple of senators who actually gave up on a deal in 1994. They look back and they think they could have gotten it if they just would have accepted the good instead of the perfect. And Rockefeller, Jay Rockefeller, was one of them. They made a decision this time not to have that happen again.
Right. I have a number of emails from people who want to talk about the politics of it. One email is from Marilyn, who's in Colorado, and she says Republicans keep claiming that all past landmark reforms were passed on a bipartisan basis, which she has in quotes. I looked up the votes on Medicare and Social Security. Both passed with overwhelming Democratic votes in favor and overwhelming Republican votes against. It's true that a handful of Republicans voted for each, but it was nothing like Republicans now claim. Also, the polling on Medicare was 28% support prior to passage. Shouldn't the media give us more background on these matters rather than letting the assertions stand? Marilyn, this is emailing from Arvada, Colorado. Okay, I can't speak to the facts on her. I have to take her word for it on the polling. Does anyone know whether that is true?
I actually looked it up. There was actually pretty strong support from both. I think in the Senate it was very strong bipartisan. Mary may have.
Are you talking about the Medicare prescription drug benefit?
No, not that one. No, Medicare is whole.
Politifact,
which does a lot of this fact checking. They declared this charge false, that these bills did not pass with strong bipartisan support.
Well, what accounts for the change today?
A lot of things. But I mean, I think early on, and we've done some reporting this at Politico, Republicans did decide early on it was going to be something that had to be killed. And the president decided after struggling with the Republicans on the Hill following the stimulus fight that he was not going to hold this up to get a Republican, and told his advisors, I want you to incorporate Republican ideas, but it's okay if we don't get any Republicans. We're going to move forward with
this. Do the Republicans benefit politically from killing the bill?
They could. Well,
or from the bill going forward? I mean, will they be seen as fighting the good fight, or will they be seen as obstructionists? That's the question.
I don't think we'll really know the answer to that until 2010.
And finally, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I think we want to hear what's going to happen next. Carrie, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. A couple more substantive questions from people who all have the same theme, which is, I can barely afford to pay my rent, car payment, and living expenses. There's no way I could afford a $250 a month health insurance premium, so writes Ricardo Espinosa. And he says that I understand the IRS will levy a fine on me if I don't purchase insurance. Can they really do that? Susan, can they really do that?
Yes, indeed, they could. It is important to step back and say everybody has to kind of think about the big picture. Affordability credits will be available to help low and moderate income people pay for this. Arguably, the insurance coverage will possibly be better than what many people have now. And that is good. That's going to mean you spend less money out of pocket on certain things. For example, a lot of preventive measures now will have no co-payments attached to them. So it's only when we're able to sort of look at the big picture that we'll understand how individuals are affected. And it's probably a good reason for us all to take a breath and see how this plays out over the next few years.
Take a breath, always a good idea. Mary Agnes, a final question to you. A listener wants to know, okay, the bill covers 94%. Who's in that other 6? That's 6% that isn't covered if this legislation goes forward.
Well, they certainly could be people who may qualify. They may not be able, for example, they may get an exemption because they can't afford, even with help, to get health insurance. They could be people. There are always people who qualify for federal assistance that don't take advantage of it. They might qualify. Medicaid will be expanded to 133% of poverty. That's around $30,000 for a family, and I want to say about $14,000 or so for an individual. They may not. Sometimes people just don't enroll. There are always some people that you don't get to.
Hold on. Susan, any further thought on that? Who is left in that 6%?
A huge core of this is going to be undocumented immigrants who cannot buy coverage. And in fact, in the Senate bill, even an undocumented immigrant cannot go purchase coverage through an insurance exchange with his or her own money. It's almost as if we turned around and said undocumented immigrants can't buy food or gasoline. You know, in fact, they can't even buy coverage with their money. So there's going to be a large pool of those folks not insured as well, and obviously, therefore, exempted from the mandate.
And this leads to my next question for Carrie. What's next in this process? And clearly, immigration reform is one of the things that Congress has to get to or should get to or wishes they could get to or wishes they could not get to if they, you know, depending on point of view. What's next for this bill?
The next thing for this bill is a series of votes this week, and then I guess Democrats are hoping they can do final passage on Christmas Eve. It'll go to a conference committee, which will be a sort of shortened conference committee. It's an effort to reconcile two bills, but it'll, as I'm told, largely run out of the leadership offices of the House and Senate with the White House's help. And then it'll go back to both chambers and they'll pass it, presumably if they can hold 60 votes. I mean, that's not assured at this point. You have Lieberman and Nelson, two moderates, saying do not change a comma in this bill that we passed today. That's obviously going to get resistance from the House. It's still, they got over a significant hurdle last night, the biggest one, I think, of this whole process. But my goodness, it's not over. It's not over yet. And there's still changes that can be made. And then after that, it's just a long road to implementation.
And what's next for you? Do you get a nap?
I hopefully will. I need one.
I want to thank you all so much for speaking with us today. Carrie Budoff-Brown is a healthcare reporter for Politico. Mary Agnes Carey is senior correspondent with Kaiser Health News. She most recently served, as we said, as associate editor for CQ Health Beat. That's a daily report on healthcare policy. And Susan Denser, editor-in-chief of Health Affairs. You can see her on the PBS NewsHour as an on-air analyst. They were all here with me in our Washington, D.C. studio, despite the snow. And we thank you all so much for being with us. I'm Michelle Martin of NPR's Tell Me More, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you all for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.